Clare FM's Beyond Belief with Father Brendan Quinlivan.
Manager, we called ya August would get falsies Jack could clawn na here knock touch the gist to click clear FM August Shahe Beyond Belief. A very good evening to you and a warm welcome to Clare FM on this Sunday night for this week's edition of Beyond Belief. I'm Brendan Quinlivan and I will be with you between now and 10 o'clock with some music and chat, and I do hope that you can stay with me and keep me company for the next hour or so. On the programme tonight, we'll have a very interesting chat with our Rome correspondent Colm Flynn, who has returned from the war zone in Ukraine, and he will be talking to us about some of his experiences there and some of the work being done by so many people on the ground, including priests and religious who are assisting in wartime. He's also been in Lourdes for the annual military pilgrimage, and he'll be talking to us about the great ceremony and the wonderful colour that he witnessed there, as well as introducing us to the idea of moral healing, which has been the focus of some of his work, talking to soldiers returning from war zones who have been making the pilgrimage to the International Marian Shrine at Lourdes in the south of France. A little later in the programme, for this sixth Sunday in the season of Easter, we'll have a lovely reflection from Sister Anne Crowley in Kilkee. So lots to look forward to on the programme. But as we are going to be visiting Rome a little later on the programme, I thought we might start with a lovely piece of music as we have just emerged from Eurovision, which took place in Turin in Italy, and one of the more famous of the Eurovision entries. This is Volare nel blu dipinto di blu.
Penso che un sogno così non ritorni mai più. Mi dipingevo le mani e la faccia di blu. Poi d'improvviso venivo dal vento rapito e incominciavo a volare nel cielo infinito. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, nel blu dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù, e volavo, volavo felice, più in alto del sole ed ancora più su. Mentre il mondo pian piano spariva lontano laggiù, una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, nel dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù, ma tutti i sogni nell'alba svaniscono perché, quando tramonta la luna li porta con sé, ma io continuo a sognare negli occhi tuoi belli, che sono blu come un cielo trapunto di stelle. Volare, oh, cantare, oh,
felice di stare qua giù e continuo a volare felice più in alto del sole ed ancora più su, mentre il mondo pian piano scompare negli occhi tuoi blu. La tua voce è una musica dolce che suona per me. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, 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 nel blu degli occhi tuoi blu, felice di stare qua giù. Nel blu degli occhi tuoi blu, felice di stare qua giù.
Music there from Domenico Modungo of Italy and Nel Blu Dipinto di Blu, better known to some of us in this part of the world as Volare. And as we've just emerged from the Eurovision Song Contest, which took place in Italy, that was a Eurovision song from way back in the day. So from the home of Eurovision this year in Torino in Italy, but a little further south in Rome, our Rome correspondent, Colm Flynn. Good evening to you, Colm. Welcome to the programme.
Beyond belief, douze poids.
At the very least. Yeah. Colm Flynn, nul point. I'm not sure about that.
Well, you know what, Brendan, beautiful song. I'm a big Eurovision fan. So when I hear you play that, everyone thinks, well, most people don't know that was a Eurovision song. Volare nel blu, dip into the blue. But it didn't win. It came third back in 1958. And it was really big for Italy because the Eurovision was only 2 years old. It started in 1956. First winner was Switzerland, Lissasius, with a song called Refrain. And this is why
we are an expert.
Yeah, this is why I have very little friends, Brendan, because I know all this stuff about the Eurovision.
Well, it's an interest. Let's put it that way. It's not everybody's interest, but it's an interest, Colm. And I'm glad that you can occupy your downtime so productively. But the Eurovision was on in Torino just a few weeks ago. And of course, great celebrations because the winning song came from Ukraine and you're not long back from Ukraine. Colm, we're seeing the images on our televisions every night. We're seeing the images of bombed out buildings, the effects of war to some extent. To be in the middle of it is a very different story. Talk to me a little bit about how you ended up in Ukraine for EWTN.
Well, it's fascinating, Father Brendan, because when I was last on with you, I had just come back from Poland and the mission there was to record a report with the refugees, the people who had newly found themselves as refugees fleeing from Poland, from Ukraine into Poland. And that was at the height of the crisis when there was something like tens of thousands a day flowing out of Ukraine into Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and other countries in Europe. So to be that close was incredible. And you asked me on the air, you said, are you going to go into Ukraine? Are you going to go to Kiev or Lviv? And to which I said, there's talk about it, but I really don't think it will happen because there's so many different things that have to line up security wise, transportation, etc., etc. Well, it just so happened that all of those things did line up. And not soon after, not long after our conversation, we flew back to Poland and we were driven to the border and somebody collected us at the border because you can't drive across. And we were brought into Lviv, first of all, which is around 2 hours from the border with Poland, regarded as being relatively safe because it's so close to Poland. And, you know, they're not striking there, not as much. The rockets have landed on that city, but they tend to keep them away from that over in the east, which is the Donbass region, what you see on television, and then Kiev, which is kind of in the center. They don't want to hit Lviv because if a rocket goes astray and hits Poland, well, then they've started a war with NATO. So we were there, we stayed with a seminary, this St. Joseph's Seminary, which has around 50 young guys in it who are studying for the priesthood. It is a big complex because back in the day they catered for hundreds of seminarians at one stage. So they had the infrastructure there, the rooms, the dining halls. And what they did was they opened it up again and now they are catering to 170 refugees who are staying there. They put us up and it was remarkable to stay with the people and to talk to them and hear their stories, their fear had dissipated somewhat because they weren't in immediate danger. The threat wasn't there on their doorstep. And they were angry. Boy, they were angry with Russia, with Putin. And they were telling us all these stories. And it's just fascinating because I'm just back from Malmo, Sweden yesterday, where I was at a broadcasting conference and we were doing a whole presentation on propaganda coming out of Russia, but then also propaganda within Ukraine itself, which isn't a very popular thing to talk about at the moment because, you know, when people say there is two sides to every story, I mean, this side, Russia is the invading force in Ukraine, and what they're doing is incredibly difficult, if not maybe impossible, to justify. But we were hearing stories from these refugees about things that Russian soldiers had done to women and to grandmothers and to children as well, terrible things. And they were saying this on camera, which was interesting for us as reporters, how much of this is propaganda that's going around on WhatsApp in their country. And they were showing us on their WhatsApp groups, look, these people in this city said the Russians came in and did this to their children and so on. Mm. And, you know, most of it we couldn't broadcast because we couldn't verify it. But then even people that we met in the Greek-Ukrainian church as well were telling us some of these things. So that was fascinating. But then to drive to Kiev, the capital, which was around 8 hours on the road, that was pretty nerve-wracking because you're like a driving target going through this country. Now, the fighting had moved away from the capital over towards the east, but it was still, you saw around you on the roads the landmines that had been defused by the Ukrainian army, the burnt out tanks, the homes destroyed by bullets, the cars of civilians, cars you would see driving around Clare, crushed like accordions by tanks rolling over them. And you think, my God, there was most likely people in some of these at the time when this happened. And so the closer we got to Kiev, the more aware you become of the absolute horror of war, and then the pointlessness of it all. You just think, when you see the destruction, you just think, for what? You know, what is this for?
They tell us, Colm, that very often truth is the first casualty of war. When you're in the middle of a war zone and you're mixing with the people on the ground who are the victims of the violence, the shells, the bombing, the intimidation, what kind of stories are you hearing from those people? What do they want the world outside of Ukraine to know?
The one thing they kept saying to me, especially young people that I met, because the young people I think were more clued in and plugged in than maybe their parents or grandparents, they were watching stuff coming from RT, which is Russia Today, a big network in Russia, and all the other Russian outlets that have a reach internationally. And so they were watching this on Facebook and so on, and they were sickened by the propaganda as they saw it, and what the Russians were being told. And remember, of course, the close ties between Ukraine and Russia, and like everyone I interviewed, even though they were Ukrainian, they would tell me half of her family or cousins all live in Russia. And the sad thing was, Brendan, there was one girl I interviewed who was a beautiful, intelligent, smart girl, much wiser for her years, 21 years of age. And she was telling me that now their family do not talk to half of their cousins in Russia, because they believe what they're seeing on TV, that this isn't a war, that this is a special military operation to protect and defend their country, Russia. So she does not talk to half of their cousins now. And you could tell that those are probably relationships that will never be rebuilt because of how horrifying what is happening. Then the other thing on the ground, when you're trying to collect stories, we would see these buildings like an apartment block, like any apartment block you would see in Ennis or anywhere, covered in bullet holes and large holes from shelling, windows smashed, apartments burnt out. And the Ukrainians who we were going around with were showing myself and the camera crew. We had a big camera crew of maybe 6-7 people. They were saying, look at the Russians. Their soldiers are animals from the country. They're uneducated. They've been drafted. They don't even know how to use these weapons. Some of them have been taken out of the prisons. And look, they're shooting at everything and anything, just firing, showering these apartments with bullets and hitting civilians. And then when I put that up on Instagram, I received a message from a viewer who was Russian and said, Colm, you're not showing the truth here, because we know that the Ukrainian soldiers are playing a dirty war, and they went up to those civilian apartments and they were firing with machine guns and rocket launchers at Russian tanks from the apartments. They initiated it. So you think, okay, if that was true, you would maybe expect to see the firing and the shelling on one certain part of the building. But, I mean, you just looked around the street and everything and anything was destroyed completely. You know, it's just, the whole thing is just, it's disgusting.
We hear a lot, I think, about people being forced underground during shelling, during air raids and so on. Did you have any experience of that while you were in Ukraine?
Yes, when we went to the capital, Kiev, which was heavily bombarded for a while at the start of this, it's intact in the middle. They didn't get into the center of the city. They didn't take Kiev, but they got to the surroundings and the suburbs were destroyed completely, like I mentioned. But they were able to hold them out. The Ukrainian forces were able to sustain and keep the center of the capital. But in the capital, you can see everything is, every monument is surrounded by a mountain of sandbags. Every church has their stained glass windows covered in sheet metal. They are in a state of readiness for combat. And the population has halved. So the population of the city went from 4 million to 2 million over a number of weeks. So half of the people left. Most places are closed and businesses are not operating. But we stayed in a hotel, this beautiful 5-star hotel. We stayed there because it was one of the only places still open. And they were offering top security, as secure as they could make it, if things were to turn very ugly all of a sudden. But when we stayed there, there was signs all over the hotel for a shelter, the bomb shelter in the basement. And you forget that you're at war sometimes, and you know, you're in this nice hotel and we're having dinner one evening, and I remarked to my colleague, it's very dark in here, isn't it, in this restaurant for the hotel? And then we realized the curtains were closed, so light could not get out. And also the windows had been stacked up with sandbags, so bullets could not get in. And it's little things like this. Then lying in bed one night in the hotel, we heard in the distance the air raid siren, and we were given access to this app that the Ukrainian government is running. And the app starts flashing, saying there's a red alert for air raid warnings. Because we were there for the Easter, they celebrate Easter a week after we do in the Greek-Ukrainian church. There was a higher chance, they believed, of attacks. There was rumors going around, but whether this was true or it was something that had spread on social media, that the Russian soldiers were writing, "Christ has risen," on the shells of bombs. That was going around, and we were getting those photographs on WhatsApp. So there was, and what did I do? I texted some of my colleagues and I said, "What are you doing? Are you going down to the shelter or not?" And they said, "We're going to stay in our rooms." And that's what I did as well.
Okay. You're a brave man. You're certainly a lot braver than I am. What about the whole idea of essential supplies, food and water and those kind of things? Do people have access to those, or is there, I know you were coming in from outside, you were journalists, you were in a hotel, but people on the ground, do they have access to essential supplies, food, water, electricity, heat?
Yes, for the most part in the West and in the center, they do. And you make a good point. You know, people keep saying, what was it like? And you're brave and this and that. To an extent, going there, I mean, I was nervous at times and scared. But, you know, we are parachuting in for a week with resources and staying in a protected hotel with security guards. You know, people are living in their homes without armed security outside and without shelters. So we were privileged. We're in a privileged position when we go into these places. But what I found remarkable was when we returned from Ukraine and I came back to Rome, and I thought that was that, my bosses then told me, "Colin, pack your bags again, because Cardinal Timothy Dolan from the United States is going over to visit. So he's going to go to Slovakia and Poland and Hungary and maybe into Ukraine, and we want you to go and cover it again." So I went back again 2 days later. But this time we were driving through Slovakia and Poland. And when I interviewed Cardinal Dolan, he went in for a short while on this top secret trip into Ukraine. In the interview I did with him, he told me that he had heard stories of the Russians poisoning the water in the east and around the Donbass region, that they were putting chemicals into the reservoirs for towns. Again, not fully verified, but he had heard it again and again. And that's what he said to me when we were on air and talking on EWTN. So if that is the kind of stuff that's starting over there, or that is happening, I mean, that, you know, you'd hate to think how that would progress and where that would go.
Yes, and again, it's like it seems like a self-defeating exercise to destroy the infrastructure of a land that you're trying to take over. And I can understand why people might have doubts about the truth of something like that. Now, among the groups of people that you were connecting with and that you met with while you were in Ukraine were groups of clergy, religious, and people working on the ground to provide humanitarian aid and relief. And again, I suppose the Catholics of the Orthodox tradition would be the strong tradition in that part of the world. Have you seen the work that they are doing and what's happening among faithful Catholics in the Orthodox tradition in that part of the world at the moment in wartime?
It is a reminder of the strength of the Catholic Church, and you see it at its best, I think, when something like this happens. And, you know, other organizations I saw were there at the border, many organizations at the border where you go in. But when you get into the real dangerous hotspots and the red zones, and you see guys with the white collar on going around, you know, I just think it's incredible. If a young person is struggling with their faith and thinking, why is the Catholic Church relevant? Why should I go to Mass? Why should I be part of this global community? I think you have to just look at something like this and say, that is why. Look at what they do here and in places like that all over the world where you have wars in Africa and so on that maybe aren't as hot in the media or publicized as much. But what I found amazing was it reminded me of the power of the white Roman collar. Because the chaplains we were filming were from the United States and they could not speak Ukrainian. Most of the Ukrainian people in the rural villages we went to, where the Russians had destroyed, kind of rolled through on the tanks, they were elderly people, they could not speak English. And on the back of the chaplains' jumpers and bulletproof jackets, it said chaplain in big writing. But when the Ukrainians saw that, they had no idea what chaplain meant. But as soon as they saw the white collar, instantly recognizable, and they flooded over and they were talking to the priest. They had no interest in me or the crew or who we were. They were focused so much on the priest, and they were telling them their stories, and it was like therapy for them. It was like, of course it wasn't healing, but it was like almost the first step of healing, talking about what they had witnessed, talking about the shelling. One lady was talking about her son being murdered. This other person was talking about bodies that were still lying in a burnt out apartment that they were living in next door. And there was a translator trying to keep up with their stories, and the priests were just listening, nodding somberly. And then they gave them a blessing, gave them some aid. But I could see the people were emotional. They were really, really touched to see the priests there.
And indeed, we've seen many images of the religious sisters manning soup kitchens and putting care packages together and really being in the thick of what's going on and on the ground, as you said, when many other agencies, for the safety of their members, stay at the border and beyond the central locations. And I find what you say about the impression they're making very interesting. In the light of what's happening here in Ireland at the moment in relation to, for example, the National Maternity Hospital, and there's a huge vilification of the nuns and the Sisters of Charity and terrible things being said about the religious in Ireland. And yet to see that when the chips are down in a place like Ukraine, people flocking to and being part of, and you were there for their Easter, and that the church and the faith community was one of the few places where they could find solace and hope.
And it's interesting when you talk about the sisters in Ireland, and, you know, we all know terrible things have happened in the past, and human beings have made terrible mistakes, and the church has made terrible mistakes. The church is trying to own up to that now, and to make what was done wrong right as much as they can. And every person I meet here in Rome, through my interviews with senior church officials down to priests and people who are just lay associates, they all recognize that and they want to do the best. But I cannot let the terrible things done by a few outweigh the amazing work done by the majority, the vast, vast majority. And I'm hearing that again the more I travel around the world and talk to people who know the faith. It's very easy, Brendan, you know this, for someone to read a newspaper article, and predominantly media and print will favor stories that are impactful, stories that should be told as well. But, you know, there's an old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. And from having worked in BBC and RTE and Associated Press and many different places, there's an element of truth to that. I used to get told in a network I worked for, when I would pitch ideas about the faith or about the church, they would say, that's WBD, worthy but dull. And they said, it's not that exciting, worthy but dull. And I'm in a privileged position in that in the last 15 years, we have been to South Korea to do a story on nuns helping children from defectors from North Korea who are sneaking out with gangs. Incredible nuns who risk their lives to look after these children. Nuns looking after street children in Angola. Sister Ethel Lormoyle, who you know from Lizzie Casey, who passed away last year. And she was 70 years in South Africa during apartheid, when there wasn't many other groups, their own government and people. And, you know, people often say, well, that's a unique story. She's unique. Those nuns are unique, but at the same time, they're not. They're everywhere you look. In every corner of the world where there is a need, you will find sisters doing incredible work. So when I hear all nuns being tarnished with this, it's complete nonsense. And people who say that you know, nuns are a force for bad and not for good overall and generally speaking, they don't know what they're talking about, really.
Well, thanks for that, those words of encouragement. And I suppose thinking too about those fantastic people who are being of service to the people of God in a war-torn country. Having emerged from it and having gone back to the border again
Father Brendan, I just want to say, because I don't, you know, people might think because the majority of my work is for EWTN, which is the Global Catholic TV Network, I'm still working and making programs for BBC. We had an Easter special on RTE, Radio 1. You know, I adhere to their guidelines and their massive and very high ethical standards. I'm not trying to be do good PR propaganda for the church. In no way am I doing that, but I have to call it as it is, and I have to call it as I see it.
You're seeking balance, I think, in what you're presenting, yeah.
And I think for other journalists who haven't been there, who don't travel the world and see these things, of course it's hard to tell those stories if they're not there telling them. So I recognize I'm a realist. I know the bad, terrible things that have been done that the church has to continue to own up to. You know, we're looking at the upcoming trip to Canada as well that the Pope will be going on. Hopefully I'll be on that trip too. But I have to tell it as it is. And it's not to give words of encouragement or try and do the church a service. It's just the reality of the what the situation is like.
Absolutely. And just from your perspective, having made that journey, not just once or twice, but in fact, three times to the border and to the Ukraine itself, is it difficult to emerge from that experience of being in a war zone and still have hope that somehow there'll be a resolution to this?
Ooh, that's a good question. And that's what we were talking about in the car driving that long 10-hour journey back to Poland. Like, what is going to happen? How is this going to end? And your guess is as good as mine. I do not know. When I interviewed Cardinal Dolan, he said two options. One, maybe because Putin's in a corner, he'll try and look for a graceful exit. Maybe he will just declare victory and let that be that. But, you know, he is an international pariah. He has been cut out of every international group. Every sanction that can be imposed has been imposed. And it doesn't seem to have stopped him. So I just don't know what is going to stop him now. Yeah.
Look at Colm. We've been chatting for a little while now, and there's something else, another experience that I wanted to talk about with you. But we might just take a little break for some music, as before we move on. I want to talk a little bit about your experience in Lourdes, and we'll be back after this piece of music.
Of the rarest. children on earth be as true as long as the boughs are radiant with flowers, as long as the azure shall keep its bright hue. Oh, Mary, we crown thee with blossoms today, queen of the angels and queen of the May. Oh,
as we're still in the month of May, that's the great Marian hymn for the month of May, the Queen of the May, bring flowers of the rarest, sung for us there by Frank Patterson. And I'm chatting with our Rome correspondent, Colm Flynn, native of Venice, living in the city of Rome, jetting around the world with EWTN and having the time of his life, too busy to do anything else because he's so busy traveling the world. You've been to one of my favorite places
actually,
in all the world.
Brendan, before before you go on to the next piece, we're going to dedicate that to my dad, Tom Flynn, because he loves that song. And I know that Gay Byrne used to play it on the first show, I think, of May when he was on the radio on the Gay Byrne Hour. So there you go.
Well, then we'll play that for Tom Flynn. And we might as well remember Noreen as well.
Of course.
We might say hello to Noreen too. But you are just back from one of my favorite places in all the world, and I haven't been there since pre-lockdown, and I miss it terribly, is the beautiful Marian Shrine at Lourdes. And you were there for a particular event that I've never been present for and often think I would like to be, the International Military Pilgrimage. Talk to me a little bit about that experience, Colm.
It was so cool to be there, my first time in Lourdes as well. And just, of course, any time you're in France is a good time. And the weather was beautiful. I went there with the TV crew, not knowing what to expect, but I always think that's the best way to go to these places to do these reports, where you don't have preconceived ideas or notions that will push you in how you make your report. But it was for the International Military Pilgrimage, where 13,000, we were there with 13,000 army men and women from armies all over the world. And this is post-COVID numbers, because before COVID, they told me that the numbers would be as high as 30,000 people. Can you imagine 30,000 soldiers descending on Lourdes? So the first thing you notice is that if you think you're going to have a nice lie-in, forget about it, because at 6:30, 7 in the morning, I was staying in a hotel right beside the grotto. You hear them marching down the street and playing their trumpets and their bands. But it's incredible to wake up to that. And then you hear the next one and the next one. And they're all marching down to the grotto. And it was started, I think it first happened in 1944, just around the end of World War II. And I think it was the French and the German and some others came together because there was so much hurt. They recognized that they needed healing. And the chaplains came together, military chaplains, first of all. It was officially established in 1958. This international military pilgrimage. So since 1958, every year, militaries from all over the world send a group of troops with their chaplains in their beautiful uniforms, their beautiful marching bands, and they have 3 days of they're looking for sometimes physical healing if they've been hurt in war, limbs missing and so on, but they're also looking for spiritual healing. But the other thing that I'd never heard about before, moral healing. How do they reconcile with things they had to do that they were against morally?
Yes. Now, actually, I find that very, I mean, as you say, it's a spectacular time to be in Lourdes. The color, the pomp and the circumstances, the marching, the military precision, all of those things. And I think that that can even sometimes veil or hide a little the depth of the meaning of a pit. Everyone that goes to Lourdes is in search of some kind of healing. As you enter the grotto there, there's that magnificent statue of Mary Salus Infirmorum, the health of the sick, and the baths, and it's Lourdes is all about healing, and almost everybody that goes there is in search of healing, whether, as you say, it's healing of emotional wounds or physical sickness, or the burden of years, or whatever it might be. But you talk about this focus on moral healing. A soldier who has had to go into battle and kill another fellow human being in defense of his country or for patriotic reasons. Or maybe it wasn't justified. What is your understanding of the moral healing that somebody like that is seeking? Reconciling their humanity with the awfulness of war, given what we were talking about before, Bring Flowers of the Rarest.
It's a great connection, and it's a fascinating area that's new, really, in science and psychology, that we're saying that there's not many studies done on this, but a few people who have done PhDs were there. They were flown in to talk to the soldiers about it, and it was fascinating. So if you look at the group we were filming were Americans, so I'll focus primarily on Americans. Many of them had served in Afghanistan and Iraq and so on. And when we were doing our interviews and when they were doing these open discussions, some of it we couldn't record, they were talking about having to kill families in some cases because they were given information that these families were armed or had grenades or would strike them first. So they would strike first and kill a family with children sometimes, and then maybe find out that they weren't armed. They were given bad information. But, you know, in the theater of war, you know, all is fair in love and war, as they say. There's just kind of the rules seem to blur and disappear. Now, of course, they have the Geneva Convention and they have all these rules that they have to go by. But so they were talking about this new phenomenon of moral healing. And the interesting thing was a lot of the soldiers told me how they reconcile with it is that they are morally okay with the outcome that they want. So the desired outcome of to take down Saddam Hussein, a brutal dictator, and liberate the people, the moral outcome of having a just war to defend your borders, and you know, you could even link that back biblically as well, the moral outcome of taking out weapons of mass destruction. But to get there, it's Guns N' Roses, that you have to they have to do things that morally they're going to struggle with forever to get to that outcome, that morally they are okay with the outcome. But then even I talked to this top US colonel about it, and he was saying, well, in the army, we're trying to raise awareness about it. But I asked him, how would this work? This could never really work in an army because it's, you know, you fall into line in an army. When a commander asks you to do something in battle, you don't think, okay, well, let me stop for a minute. Am I morally okay with this or not? You have to just do what you're told. And that's how armies work. And that's why they have such a rigid and structured system of where you fall in the pecking order. So it is a fascinating thing of how can they preach this, but implement it as well in the ranks of the army, this kind of moral healing.
But the church itself for centuries has struggled with it. I mean, they came up with, right from Thomistic scholastic philosophy, the notion of the just war theory, that the church has upheld a just war, that there is such a thing as a just war, provided you are not the aggressor and you use commensurate force, and there's all sorts of conditions. So that even the church itself has struggled with this. So the healing, or the moral healing, Lourdes, I mean, when we think of physical and emotional healing and those kind of things, they all make sense. But this sense of moral healing, did you see much of that going on, or how was it working in a place like Lourdes?
It was working in that they were given talks and they were told first how to identify it, because a lot of these soldiers have PTS. I'm told now that you can't say PTSD anymore, it's PTS. So they have this anxiety, they wake up with nightmares and they don't know what it is. So they were trying to say, well, first of all, you need to recognize that perhaps this is a moral injury that you have. You don't have a physical injury, this could be a moral injury. So recognizing it is the first thing. Why you did it, the command you were given, did you trust that it was a just thing you had to do? But even the whole idea, I was talking to someone from the Knights of Columbus who were bringing over these soldiers who were sponsoring it, a very Catholic organization, of course, the Knights of Columbus. And after the war in Afghanistan, they had presented veterans with awards for their bravery and their service. And someone told me, I won't mention the names because they didn't really want it on the record, but a bishop in the United States wrote to them, the Knights of Columbus, and said, as a Catholic organization, this war was never just. You cannot be presenting these people with these awards for what they did. But those soldiers have to trust that the government, that the officials, the colonels have worked it out. They've done the equations and they have in their mind came to the conclusion that it is a just war. And we know now in hindsight, sometimes often it's not.
And in certain cases, that wasn't their call. So therefore, it wasn't their responsibility. It was people higher up the chain who had to make the call and the decision. And yet you can still feel complicit in the moral disintegration or denigration that is occurring. And I'm fairly sure there'll be a lot more that we'll hear about that into the future. Did you say it was your first time in Lourdes?
First time there, yes, sir.
First time in Lourdes. And it has a great affection for Irish people. You know, that great gold crown and cross on the top of the Rosary Basilica was presented by the people of Ireland back in the 1930s. So there's a great affection between, and a great connection between. Somebody said to me one time, Irish people used to go to Lourdes, but they'd come back from Lourdes. They were Frenchified for the 4 or 5 days they were there, and they knew how to pronounce it properly by the time they came home. So it has great affection. Lourdes is great, and I've been there countless times, every year almost since the age of 16. And the grotto is a very special place with the River Gave behind. It's a very special place to be, especially late at night. Did you have that experience?
I had that experience, and the candles twinkling and flickering around you in the dark of the night, and the river that you mentioned, what we were struck by, it's right next to the grotto, of course, and you can lean by the wall of the river and hear it gently behind you looking at Our Lady and the candles. It's a beautiful, beautiful experience. And someone beside me said, because the river, we all commented, was very, very high, very high, very fast flowing and very silent. Yes. Everyone kept remarking about how quiet it was. And somebody said to me, isn't it beautiful here, Cullum? I'm in front of Our Lady praying, and all the hurt I have, the baggage and everything that I feel emotionally weighs me down in my life, I put it in front of Our Lady and I feel like I'm just tossing it in the river. And it's silently and quickly going away, and I can watch it floating away. And I thought that was a beautiful metaphor. And the one last thing I'll say about Lourdes, is that, when I was walking around, I was like, what is so special about the atmosphere here? As I kept walking up and down the streets, when the TV crew go to get what we call B-roll, scenic shots and shots of things, they don't need me, they don't want me around. I've annoyed them enough, and they're sick of me. So they say, Cullum, you go for a walk and we'll keep filming. But there was such a beautiful atmosphere. And then I realized, as you said, everyone's there for a reason. And the people who walk by you, they could be in a wheelchair, they could have a limp. You might not see the ailment. They could look like they're absolutely fine, but there's something maybe in their body physically, something in their heart, something in their soul that they're carrying. You have people with special needs, you have the elderly. The great leveler is that everyone is there for some sort of healing. There's no pretentiousness. No one is putting on airs. No one is trying to impress or be someone they're not. Everyone is there as they are. And there's something really just beautiful about that. You can be yourself and you see that in others. And everyone has that kind of like smile on their face and in their eyes when they look at you. Because they know everyone's there for the same cause. And it's a beautiful experience. If anyone hasn't been, I would recommend go. And go now before the tourists all come streaming back. The tourists have not come streaming back yet.
Yes.
So, and I think they're starting flights again, or maybe I'm thinking of somewhere else. I could be thinking of Malta, but
well,
get on
if
over.
If it's of any help to our listeners, they'll know we covered it here on the program before. The Killaloe Diocesan Pilgrimage is going the end of June for 5 days. And then there's one at the beginning of October for the autumn pilgrimage, staying at the Agena and the Solitude Hotels. And if you contact Joe Walsh Tours, you can book your place on the Killaloe pilgrimage. Now, this year, they're not bringing the assisted pilgrims for the time being because there were still restrictions in place when it was being set up. But if you contact Joe Walsh Tours, the Killaloe pilgrimage, and the good thing about the Killaloe pilgrimage is direct flight from Shannon.
There you go.
So you don't have far to go. And Shannon is a fabulous airport to go through because security, all those kinds, it's a fantastic, better parking, less hassle, and it's on our doorstep. Yeah. So the Killaloe pilgrimage is going the end of June and the beginning of October.
Brendan,
for anybody
does it fly? Does it fly straight to Lourdes Airport?
Yes,
or does it go to Toulouse?
Lourdes Tarbes Airport.
Brilliant. That's where we flew out of, but we had to fly into Toulouse, and that was a 2-hour drive. But if you're going to Lourdes, go out and get your ticket now. I don't know how much it is, but it's worth every cent. I can tell you that.
I should have been prepared and have the price list here. Tom Ryan, who is the director of the pilgrimage, will kill me that I didn't advertise it well enough. Look at Colm, I can't thank you enough. We've had a longer chat than usual tonight, but I do think that the Ukraine story and your experience there, and then your experience in Lourdes was really worth sharing. Lots of things coming up. So I look forward to chatting to you again the next time I'm on air. And you make my life very easy as I put this program together every month or so.
No, Brendan, when you braked for a piece of music and said we'll be back with Colm, I thought, oh, the other man hasn't shown up. Here I am.
There may be more truth in that than I'm prepared to admit live on air. Colm, we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you so much. Good night and God bless you.
Ciao. God bless Father Brendan. Thank you as always.
Buonasera.
Buonasera, signorina, buonasera. It is time to say goodnight to Napoli. Though it's hard for us to whisper buonasera with that old moon above the Mediterranean Sea. In the morning, signorina, we'll go walking where the mountains help the sun come into sight. And by the little jewelry shop we'll stop and linger while I buy a wedding ring for your finger.
In the meantime, let me tell you that I love you.
Buonasera, signorina, kiss me goodnight. Buonasera, signorina, kiss me goodnight. But red do that to the pot, bona body boat, but do the bottle boat. Buonasera, signorina, buonasera. It is time to say goodnight to Napoli. Though it's hard for us to whisper, buonasera, with that old moon above the Mediterranean Sea. In the morning, signorina, we'll go walking where the mountains help the sun come into sight. And by the little jewelry shop we'll stop and linger while I buy a wedding ring for your finger.
And in the meantime, let me tell you that I love you.
While I buy a wedding ring for your finger.
In the meantime, let me tell you that I love you.
Buonasera, signorina, kiss me goodnight. Buenos Aires, señorina, kiss me goodnight. Pseudo señorina, kiss me goodnight.
Buonasera, señorina, kiss me goodnight. You're tuned to Clare FM on this Sunday night, and this is Beyond Belief. And I suppose our music has something of an Italian flavour tonight. That was the voice of Louis Prima and Buonasera. That is all in honour of our guest tonight, Colm Flynn. And thank you, Colm, for sharing with us your experience in Ukraine and also those interesting insights to the idea of moral healing and the international military pilgrimage to Lourdes. Just as we were talking there, just to remind you that the Killaloe Diocesan Pilgrimage to Lourdes is being renewed and is taking place this year, the summer pilgrimage from the 28th of June to the 3rd of July, and the autumn pilgrimage from the 2nd to the 7th of October. This is the 65th annual pilgrimage to Lourdes and will be led by our Bishop, Bishop Fintan Monaghan. And of course, as I said, one of the great advantages of travelling to Lourdes with the Killaloe Diocese is that we have that international airport on our doorstep, the wonderful Shannon Airport. We'll be travelling from there to Lourdes Tarbes and indeed back again. And I didn't have the prices while I was talking to Colm, but it ranges from 739 to 759 euro. And if you are interested, you can contact Joe Walsh Tours by email. And their email is info@joewalshtours.ie. And if you are interested in going, it's not too far away from the summer pilgrimage. Now may be the time to sign up for that. Well, we are, of course, in the great season of Easter. And as I always remind people with the two great seasons of the church, Christmas and Easter, they don't just apply to the day itself, but indeed go on for several weeks afterwards. The season of Easter continues through all of these weeks, right up to the Feast of the Ascension, and concludes with the great and solemn celebration of the coming of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. And so, by way of reflection, as we come towards the end of tonight's programme, we welcome Sister Anne Crowley from Kilkee with a reflection for this sixth Sunday in the season of Easter.
Beautiful morning, day of hope, dawn of a better time. Jesus is risen. Death could not hold him who was, who is, and is to come. There is good news for the poor, the rescued. Love overcame death. May the promise of your Spirit, Lord, light up our lives. May the love you revealed shape our journey. May the joy of your kingdom fill our hearts and homes. Change our lives, change our hearts to be Easter messengers, to protect and not destroy. We run to the tomb of life. We hurry to see for ourselves. We look with the eyes of faith. We sense your presence. God is revealing his beloved Son today. What truth is he offering? What food is he giving us? A song, a vivid dream, a piece of poetry, a walk in the woods, a loving friend, a new sense of purpose. O risen one, you generate surprise and delight. Nurture the potential that sleeps in us. Season of resurrection, sacrament of promise, awaken us.
Give us your peace, O God. Give us your peace, your peace. Give us your peace, O God. Give us your peace, your peace. When we're afraid, running from truth, gather us back to you. Take every fear and fill our hearts. Give us your peace, O God. give us your peace. Oh God, give us your peace. Your peace, give us your peace. Oh God, give us your peace. Your peace. When we are tired, weary and worn, take us into your arms. Where there is no need, there is no want, give us your peace. Oh God, give us your peace. Oh God, give us your peace. Your peace, give us your peace. Oh God, give us your peace. Your peace.
Sin a bhfuil uaim seo cairde anocht, gur míle maith agaibh go léir as mhór go deachta, tá súil am gur bhain sibh tanamh agus sult as an gláir anocht. Can I remind you that tonight's programme, if you want to listen back, you can do so on the Clair FM catch-up service. Go dí go mé mid le chéile arísht an teachtain seo chuaing, go dé sibh go léir slán agus beannacht dé oraibh ar fad.